Okay, folks, welcome to Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for joining us again. And delighted to say that once again I'm with the wonderful and magnificent Leslie Ann Jones. And Leslie Ann, you were just saying to me on the way up to the studio today how nice it is for so many people to get back to us and tell us how much they like the last couple of podcasts we've done.
It's really lovely. You know, people take time out to make contact.
And, indeed.
Largely to agree with us.
Yes.
Quite substantially to disagree with us, but that's great as well.
Yep.
Because, you know, there are three sides to every story, right?
Oh, yeah.
His, hers, and the truth.
Yes. Yes. That's right, yeah. Never let the truth get in the way of a good story. We've both been had that fed down our throat for many, many years as Fleet Street journalists. I'm going to tell you something now which you may or may not agree with, but of course, you come from... do you come from rural Wales, Leslie Ann?
Actually, no.
Because we did a story about a sheep, didn't we, in the last podcast?
Yeah, no, not strictly speaking rural. Although it's pretty rural now.
Yes.
So, Merthyr Tydfil, my family hail from.
Merthyr Tydfil.
Traditionally known as a bit of a shithole, actually.
Well, I've been to Merthyr Tydfil. When I worked for the Express in Manchester, you used to do a lot of stories in those North Wales. There was one place there, there's a village around there somewhere, near Merthyr Tydfil or Blaenau Ffestiniog or somewhere like that, where they've got a mountain and the mountain's about to fall into the town and they've put a huge chain around it, believe it or not.
Well, there was a lot of that because there were slag heaps, weren't
yeah,
there?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So you remember the Abba Van disaster in 1966?
In fact, the anniversary of that has just come and gone.
Yes, it has.
Sadly, yeah.
But a lot of it's grassed over now.
Yeah.
It's very close to the Brecon Beacon.
Yeah.
The Brecon Beacons, which is one of the most beautiful places in the world.
And most dangerous if you get stranded there late at night in the winter, because that's why the SAS go up there and test their men.
Yeah. But it is beautiful, yeah. No, I love it.
Yeah. So what I'm going to ask you is, this is rather a blunt question, have you ever shagged a farmer?
Not to my knowledge.
Right, because you see, the thing is, they had a recent survey.
Shagriculture.
Yeah, shagriculture.
I love that word.
In which they, what they've done is, this is not a survey conducted independently, it's a survey in which they've invited different professions to submit, right, their own beliefs and their attractiveness to women, and farmers, believe it or not, came out on top as the most egotistical, self-important men in relationships with women. But I mean, look, you know, I'm a heterosexual male and I like women. I can't imagine any woman wanting to have sex with a farmer with a pair of welly boots on, tromping around in manure all day long, driving tractors and basically being rather uncultured, can you?
I don't think I'd fancy that at all. I mean, your average farmer is not going to be... tremendously educated, shall we say? Have many of them got university degrees? Are they quite basic people?
I think they're very much a distinct community, farmers, right? And I'll tell you why.
I'm not trying to say a bit thick, but you know what I'm saying.
Well, do you know, they're either gentleman farmers or they're farmers who have small holdings and they don't make much money.
Rough red hands, all that kind of stuff.
But I tell you what is interesting. I worked once in Newcastle, right, and of course Northumberland is a huge agricultural area, and there's an agricultural college at Newcastle University, right, and whenever there was problems with punch-ups in the town or anything like that, or excessive drinking clubs and all that, a lot of them came from the agricultural college, and even worse, the main agricultural college in this country is at Cirencester, Cotswolds, okay? And of course, the Cotswolds is one of the most prosperous rural areas in this country. And I mean, I've heard stories come out of there when you go to Cheltenham, right? The Cheltenham Festival, the meeting, and an awful lot of people there from the Cirencester Agricultural College. And these guys are as out of control in their world as old Bojo and David Cameron were in the what was that club called? It
The Bullingdon Club.
The Bully Boys, yeah, the Bullingdon
Isn't
Club.
Isn't this where the posh lots send their sons who are likely to fail at academic university courses? So they send them to an agricultural college.
You're absolutely right. Traditionally, right, if the thick son had failed to get into Oxford or Cambridge, he either went to the agricultural college at Cirencester or he went into the army.
Yeah.
That was the, other two.
They're not my type at all.
No.
I would prefer to be lured and talked into bed by somebody with
charm.
Literary tendencies and charm.
And wearing a nice suit.
You know, nice and clean.
Yes.
Completely scrubbed.
Yes.
I don't want any whiff of manure near
mate. No. Exactly.
This is not going to be my type.
I totally agree. So I just wonder why who are these farmers shagging? Is it the local barmaid?
Maybe the sheep.
That's a bit harsh. Do you know, that is harsh, but quite seriously, because I come from Chester, and that's on the verge of North Wales, and we just talked about that. But when I was growing up and, people were in business and all that, they told me that it was not unusual for farmers, and this is a horrible subject, we'll mention it very briefly, to actually indulge in relationships with sheep.
Oh, sure, it is a thing. It is. Can you imagine?
Well,
I mean,
not really.
Can I say this in a delicate way? Have you ever been to one of these petting farms with little children where they can go in?
When my niece and nephew were very small, we used to go to one of what they called a working farm down in Surrey, right? And see the little sheep, as you say.
Godstone Farm is one of the places.
Which one?
Godstone.
That's right. Yeah, Godstone.
Take the children.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, without being too specific, the rear end of your average sheep is quite maggoty.
Oh, dear.
Do you want to go near that?
No. I think we'll move on. This is just about these farmers, anyway. They say scientists have the least amount of nookie, according to their own submission.
No, you see, a scientist would do it for me.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Why?
Yeah, because I'm absolutely thrilled by science.
Yeah.
I wasn't very good at science at school because I wasn't very good at maths.
Right.
And if you were very good at maths, you could do physics and chemistry up until O level, but they weren't going to let you any further.
No.
So I'm fascinated by it because it's not something I'm really very good at.
Right.
So anyone who has greater knowledge than me on those kind of terms, I'm going to find thrilling, yeah.
Okay.
Brian Cox.
Yes.
Brian May, these kinds of men. Astrophysicists.
Well, Brian May certainly. I mean, fancy being a rock god, as he certainly was.
And an astrophysicist.
And an astrophysicist. And a campaigner for badgers.
Badgers.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Do you remember that film, A Fish Called Wanda?
Yes.
Where John Cleese is speaking Russian
and
Jamie Lee Curtis is practically having a meltdown with desire because he's speaking Russian.
Yes.
It's that kind of effect on me,
right,
a scientist.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. These farmers claim they have sex every day. When it comes to the most sex,
by themselves,
I've no idea. Farmers say we are on top. A third boast that they do
literally
the deed.
Literally on top.
Yeah. Literally on top. A third boast that they do the deed at least once a day. And
fantasists.
And the next guys claiming to have a lot of sex are architects.
Oh, okay.
How about that? Yeah.
It
says here, farmers claim that because of the level of physical activity in their working day, they're always bursting with energy. And
not just energy.
Yeah, that's right. And they need a way to sort of get rid of the energy. Lifestyle factors such as flexibility of working hours and the environment are also likely to help them.
Have we seen the kind of women they consort with?
Well, this is what I'm thinking. I mean, talk about having a role in the
hay. Do farmers' wives tend to have lots of children? I mean, that's the acid test, isn't it?
Well, I think they do, don't they? They have big broods of children all living in the farmhouse.
Maybe.
I can't stand farms. I hate farms.
They stink.
They stink, they're filthy, and people have got mud on their boots all the time.
Yeah. And dogs. And they bring all that in the house.
And I have to say, a lot of country life doesn't appeal to me either. So I had a mate who lived in Wiltshire, in a little village outside of Marlborough. Now, he married into a local family, and the local family were so countryfied, it was unbelievable. So, for instance, people would walk in and out the house in welly boots across their carpets.
No. Not in my house.
But they weren't carpets. They were like mats, all over the place.
That Hessian stuff.
That's right. And all kind of stuff.
And they never vacuum.
Well, they'd sit down on raw, rustic wooden tables, and they didn't. I mean, I'm not being fine, but they didn't really wash their hands.
The cat walks all across the worktop.
Into
the cheesecake.
I mean, they just had strange sort of living habits compared to us. You know,
we're very hygienic people,
yeah,
and we're very processed.
Yes.
You know, we wouldn't dream of coming to studio without having a shower, all that kind of thing. They probably have a bath a week.
And the dogs walking all over the place in the house as well, jumping up on the couch and all that kind of stuff. You know.
Yeah.
And even the garden was always sort of messy and that kind of stuff, because it was the land and all that kind of stuff.
Animals use it as a toilet, yeah.
Let me get there.
I have to lie down now.
Listen, I tell you what I want to talk to you about, because I like talking to you about famous people. Just about a week ago, old Cher is back in town.
Oh, we love Cher.
Right? Do we love Cher? Why do we love Cher?
Why do we love Cher? She's a living relic, isn't she? She's a bit like Joan Collins.
She did the O2, right?
Yeah.
Sellout show at 70 years of age, changed her outfit 16 times, and didn't get less than a 5 out of 5 star rating from any reviewer.
She's perfect. You've seen the latest Mamma Mia film, in which she rocks up as the grandmother.
Oh, no, I haven't seen that.
Oh, my goodness. She lifts that film for me.
Right.
We all agree. She's fantastic. I was at a funeral yesterday, which we'll talk about some other time.
No, we're going to talk about it in a minute.
Some next-door neighbours of ours from Donkeys years ago turned up. They live in Suffolk, and they turned up. Hadn't seen them for 40 years. Mm-hmm. And this lady's brother, who lives in Missouri, his wife, Monica Beckett, was Cher's personal assistant for 20-odd years.
Right.
And they said, we must tell you our Cher story, because it's something we had in common, was a celebrity story.
Yeah.
And her husband said, yes, in all earnestness, he said, yes, we've seen Cher in the nude. Mm. I said, how come?
Yeah.
He said, well, you know, Monica was the personal assistant for all those years.
Yes.
And we got invited out on one of the tours.
Right.
And they had us backstage.
Yeah.
And Cher was in the shower. And she came out, not realising that guests were already going to be in her dressing room.
Right.
And he said all she was wearing was a towel.
Right.
And that was on her head.
Oh, golly.
And she just said, hi, guys. Mm. Very pleased to meet you. Completely unembarrassed.
Mm.
But I went on tour with her years ago in the 90s
when
Angie Best was her personal assistant.
Oh, okay. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
And she had this most astonishing trailer.
Yes.
It was like the kind of place you'd imagine a fortune teller, sort of caravan.
Yeah.
You know, all done out in kind of midnight blue with twinkling stars.
Right.
In the
okay.
She's tiny weeny, Cher. She seems enormous on stage.
Yes.
Bit like Freddie Mercury, you know, really small guy, about my size.
Yeah.
And then he'd stroll out on stage and he'd suddenly treble in size.
Well, he had such long legs.
In front of an audience.
He seemed to have such long
legs. Yeah, but not really. Not in real life.
In stretched white trousers all the time.
No, but he trebled in size.
Right, okay.
In front of an audience.
Yeah, but he did.
She's very similar. And there were all those stories, if you remember, about she'd had the lower pairs of ribs removed.
Yes, that's right.
Cinch in her waist.
Yes, yes.
And all that kind of thing.
Yes.
But she was fabulous.
She used to live, for some bizarre reason, in Wapping, in an apartment in Wapping.
Okay.
And she rang in on a radio show I was doing once.
Right.
Because we were discussing something about, I don't know, boats on the river or something, you know, speeding boats or something like that. And she actually rang in. And you had to do one of these kind of double take checks, you know. Are we sure it's Cher? They have to find out what her birth date
sure
is.
Are you sure?
Yeah, are you sure you're Cher? and get a... That, in fact, exactly the same thing happened with Rod Stewart, because we were defending Rod against an attack by a nefarious female journalist about his house being full of chintz. He was trying to sell his house. And she'd got hold of the estate agent's material. Said, look at all this dreadful furniture. So I attacked her on air and said, you know, what does she know about living in a £7.5 million house? You know what I mean?
Sure.
And Rod was listening in the car. That's right. And he rang in. And that's how we got to sort of...
Established your rapport.
Rod, yeah, that's right. And all that kind of stuff.
The best line in that Mamma Mia film.
Yes.
She rocks up at the granddaughter's party. And the granddaughter meets her at the helicopter.
Right.
The first glimpse of Cher is her foot coming down out of the helicopter in a fantastic stiletto heel shoe. And she says, Grandma, you weren't invited. Mm. And Cher says, that's the best kind of party, little girl.
Yeah, yeah.
Great line.
It's brilliant. The one thing I can watch over and over again is the video on USS New Jersey, right? And it is so provocative. Cher sitting astride a massive, you know, sort of huge...
Careful.
..gun barrel.
Okay.
Right, right.
Okay.
Yeah, seriously. With like 1,000 sailors. And they filmed the video there for, you know, what was the song? I'm going to find the time. I'm going to turn back time. Yeah. I'm going to turn back time.
He's off, folks.
And the thing is, I read, I was living and working in America when she made that. And USS New Jersey is an historic ship. It's like we have one parked on the Thames here, the HMS Belfast,
oh,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the USS New Jersey is the American ship from the Second World War, which was used as recently,
I
by the way.
I've been on that. Doesn't it have a Concorde on it that you can...
I don't know.
A sort of decommissioned Concorde and you can go, I took the kids on, yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, yeah. But it was in service as recently as the 80s when Ronald Reagan was in power. He brought it back into commission to start... excuse me, shelling Beirut.
Oh, yeah.
When the Americans lost 145 Marines, you know, in a terrible attack. And so it's a very, very famous ship. But I read the piece about how she suddenly turned up, you know. So the captain was only told that morning, it was still a working ship, you know, we're doing a deal with the record company today. It's been passed by the Pentagon, everybody. And said, my ship's not a fucking, you know, stage. It's a warship and all that. He said, what are we doing? And they said, well, Cher's coming to make a video here. He said, what? Cher? Here? What? And they had to have so much security to keep the men in order because... sailors, generally speaking, don't see people like Cher on their ship. You know what I mean?
And they not for real, only on pages stuck on the ceilings of their bunk. Yeah.
And so they had to give over not just the captain's quarters, but all the admiral's quarters, anybody else, to turn into her dressing room. I mean, it's a massive operation to get her on the ship, get her changed.
She doesn't wear very much, so it doesn't need much space.
No.
Do you remember
needs...
that incredible outfit, the sort of V-shaped ribbon? And
yeah,
that was
exactly.
It covered the nipples and the kind
And the rest was all netting.
Yeah,
completely. And all that. Well, that's exactly how she looked on that ship.
Amazing figure she has.
Absolutely amazing. Amazing woman. Glad
Long
she's
may she live. We adore her.
70 years of age. And let's hope we all age as elegantly as she does. Okay, folks, I want to tell you about HelloFresh, okay? HelloFresh is the UK's leading recipe box service. It delivers fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes to your door. It's the easy, convenient way to cook delicious dinners. It really is, believe me. You do it from scratch every time. Choose your recipes from 19 favourites every week, including rapid recipes, okay, ready in as little as 20 minutes. Family favourites, British and world cuisine, and even a balanced range of under 600 calories foods, okay? And because all our ingredients at HelloFresh come direct from our suppliers and are pre-portioned for you, there's no food waste, okay? Now, I want to tell you the particular recipes that I've been looking at just recently because I like to vary it as much as HelloFresh do. Creamy mustard chicken with the stir-fried greens and mash. Duck à l'orange with parsley mash and roasted carrots, and even one that really turned me on, venison ragu, okay? So I want you all to concentrate on those recipe options and get yourself into it, okay? You can enjoy delicious moments with HelloFresh. Head to hellofresh.co.uk, choose a box, a delivery slot, and add your favourite recipes, delicious dinners from scratch. HelloFresh are offering our listeners... that's the listeners to Planet Porky, £60 off your first four boxes, okay? That's £15 off each of your first four boxes, total saving of £60. Visit www.hellofresh.co.uk and enter the code Planet Porky at the checkout to enjoy delicious dinners without the drama. Let me give you that again, please. HelloFresh offering our listeners £15 off your first four boxes, total saving of £60. Visit www.hellofresh.co.uk and enter the code PLANETPORKY at the checkout to enjoy delicious dinners without the drama. Right, OK, folks, thank you very much indeed for sticking with us. This is Life on Planet Porky, myself and the wonderful Leslie Ann Jones. Now, Leslie Ann, I hope you don't mind if I start now moving into a bit of personal territory for you, but it's something I want to do, and I've cleared this with you before we've come to air. I was a journalist, I am a journalist, you're a journalist, your father was a journalist, a very famous journalist, Ken Jones, and when I was a kid and used to read a magazine called Goal, one of the first weekly magazines, the star writer was a man in an immaculate suit with a white shirt and a tie, and he stared out at you from the page. His name was Ken Jones. He's your father, one of the originals, one of the great names of journalism and sports writing. Very sorry to have to record that your father passed away recently. And, of course, you had to go through all the trauma of that, your mother's still alive. and you laid your father to rest quite recently. And so I'd like to pay tribute to him in my own way by letting the audience know the effect your father had on the world of sport, just mentioning two names. One of them, George Cohen, right full-back for England in 1966, turned up at his funeral at 80 years of age.
On his birthday.
On his very birthday, unbelievable. And the other one is anybody who's been into sport over the last 40 years will know a man called Colin Hart. Colin Hart, the boxing writer for The Sun, and probably the leading authority on boxing in this country, if not this world, suffering throat cancer, I think. He turned up as well. Tell us a little bit about the rest.
So, my father came from probably the most successful footballing family this country ever produced.
Yeah.
And people today haven't really heard of them, but my grandfather played for Everton. My great-uncle Bryn was transferred from Wolves to the Arsenal for a world record transfer fee.
Wow.
£14,500.
Wow.
There was a demonstration in Downing Street on the day because there was a protest at this amount of money being paid for a mere footballer.
Really? What
when
year was
Europe
that, you
was
know?
On the brink of war, 1939.
Wow.
And then... Yeah. So five brothers, whose own father had been down the mines as an iron miner, out of nowhere, this talent to play football.
Yes.
And five brothers all came up from the mines to become...
Now, where does Cliff Jones come into
this? He's the next tier down. So it was five brothers and three of their sons.
Yes.
One of which is my Uncle Cliff.
Yes.
Who became very famous.
He was the winger for Spurs in the double winning team.
And he's still
very
going.
Famous. Yeah, still going.
He was at my father's funeral. They were brought up... they're actually cousins, but they were brought up as brothers.
Right, OK.
And conquered alcoholism.
Yes.
Is now an ambassador for the club and still going
I think
very
he weighs the same weight now as he did when he retired from football, doesn't he, Cliff
Jones?
Yeah,
he looks great. He looks fantastic.
Yeah.
My father was almost 88
right. When
he died.
Yes.
And he was more than ready. And I find it superfluous to be sad that he'd reached the end of a very adventurous, exciting, thrilling life, which took him all over the world, met some of the most famous legends in sport, was one of Muhammad Ali's preferred journalists. He was at Deer Lake, the training camp in Pennsylvania in the 1970s when Ali was preparing for, you know, his most legendary fights.
Do you know, I read an obituary I've mentioned in these podcasts before that I keep an eye on the obituaries because I like to see the tributes of famous people. I think a guy called Neil Anderson or Neil Jones, he was a Times sports writer who also got into boxing, passed away recently. I read him. And again,
it was Neil Allen.
Neil Allen.
Yes.
Thank you very much indeed. Neil Allen. That's absolutely right. And he was of the same era of as your father, you know, and did all that stuff.
And Hugh McIlvenny, of course.
Hugh McIlvenny.
My father and he were best friends for more than 60 years.
Unbelievable.
Crashed around the world.
Yeah.
Always shared a hotel room.
Yes.
You know, there was money for them to have one each.
Sure.
But they preferred to share.
Yeah.
They sat at the bar in Costello's, putting the world to rights.
Costello's my second home when I was in New York.
Great Hemingway favoured, Huck favoured bar.
Jimmy Lawton, maybe.
There you are, Jimmy
James Lawton.
James Lawton, Hugh McIlvenny.
That's right.
My father.
Yep.
And Colin Hart, probably. You know, that era will never be repeated.
Yeah, Colin's an amazing guy. I just mentioned he came to your father's funeral, gave a eulogy, I think, despite the fact he's suffering a bit of throat cancer.
He struggled to get it up, but when we asked him to do it, there was no question.
Yeah.
He said, I would have been offended had you asked anybody else.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
It was a joyous occasion. The sun came out.
Yes.
Everybody there was bathed in sunlight.
And you had a Welsh choir.
We had a recording of the Neath male voice choir singing Mifanwy by Dr. Joseph Parry, who also, like my father, came from Merthyr Tydfil. Mm.
Yeah.
And the voices in the chapel, because there were a lot of people up from the valleys.
Yes.
We had all the harmonies, all the descants. Mm. The volume of music in that place was phenomenal.
Absolutely lovely. Just to let people know about the quality of your father's workmates and friends, when I was very young, I was the express reporter in New York before I was 30. I was about 27. And the great thrill of working in New York was you got so many different opportunities, do so many different things. You know, one minute you'd be writing a Wall Street story about a financial crash, and next you'd be chasing Diana, Princess of Wales, around the Caribbean on a yacht. And then on this particular occasion, I was asked to go to, not Las Vegas, it was Atlantic City, because that's on the East Coast, you know. So sometimes if the fight was Atlantic City, then head office in London wouldn't send a boxing writer over, particularly if it wasn't a great fight, you know. It was quicker just to do it from New York. So we go down in a stretch limo, myself and Paul Connew from The Mirror. You know, Paul. I think. I see Paul appear occasionally now on television.
On Sky, yeah.
On Sky. And he's always described as former Sunday Mirror editor. But if my planning's right...
News of the World, right?
Well, no, the thing is, I think he was acting editor at both. He was definitely acting editor at the News of the World, but he never got the main job.
No, he didn't.
And with no disrespect to Paul, who's, you know, been around the houses like we all have, I thought he was only acting editor at Sunday Mirror. He might have been editor for a few weeks. You've got to remember that during our lifetime, we've probably known 40 or 50 editors, you know?
Exactly.
But anyway, So the sports editor rings me up. Mike, can you? Yeah, cool, yeah, boxing, don't worry about it, man. You know, I'm born in a boxing ring, you know. Butlin's champion at the age of 8 at Pathelli. I've got my cup. Butlin's boxing champ. So I said, yeah. So I'd never done a fight before in my life, done nothing about it. So I'm sitting ringside the night of the fight. It was a guy called Donald Lee, who was an American, big American, was fighting Chris somebody. Chris, I can usually remember it, but I can't under pressure at the moment. But the point of my story is that Donald Lee smacked the English boxer so hard, his nose burst, and this fountain of blood came out of our boxer's face. It curled up in the air like that, came down in an arc and landed all over my head and my phone. Because in those days, you had to have a ringside phone,
yeah,
okay?
A plugged-in phone.
Yes, that's right. You
mobile.
Took it with you. That's right. Absolutely. So I was... And you've got to remember, American time, you're 5 hours late already to get your copy back to London for that night's edition, that day's edition, you know. And I was going to be knackered. Anyway, sitting on my left was Colin Hart. And from the Sun, I said, Cole, what do I do, you know? And he said, don't worry, we'll sort you out and all that kind of stuff. And Cole went off and found me another phone, you know, because the phone was literally jammed up with blood, you know. He couldn't make it work. It was a push-button phone rather than a dial phone,
how
you know.
Lovely.
And Cole helped me through it, virtually filed my copy, you know. I said, what round did that happen and what round did that happen? And that, you know, developed a lifelong friendship. And years later, when I was running Talk Sport, the one man I always wanted in was Colin Hart, you know, to give us the lowdown on the boxing, and he always was. So
one great thing about those sports writers from that era,
yes,
they were always so willing to help the next generation,
you know,
because they'd been helped.
Yes.
And my dad always said, you've got to hand the baton on.
Yes.
Because people helped us, brought us up, and now it's our duty to do that for the next generation of journalists.
Yes, absolutely.
You don't get much of that nowadays.
No, what you get these days is... You see, that did happen in those days, but also because newspapers were the only medium, all the writers were fiercely competitive, and it was understood that if halfway through dinner that night, one of you got a call because the paper that the other guy works for had dropped, they got an exclusive, that was fair. That was fair enough. You know, you had to get exclusives. What you always used to do, what I always used to do, was carry my copy around in my inside pocket, and the moment my opponent got the call, I'd just whip it out and say, they are, mate, because then... It looked like he was onto the story rather than chasing it. You see what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the way we used to do it.
Yeah.
And in fact, and funny enough, I'm getting off your dad a bit here, but it's the world of journalism in which he lived. We went to some places where some of our colleagues had reached a stage where they were so pissed all the time, they couldn't file their copy, and we would file it for them. And that happened a lot in the sporting world.
Yeah.
Guys who just got out, you know, they'd just lost it and they'd come to the end of their careers. A guy called Henry Miller in America, he worked for The Telegraph. We all went down to Barbados. Henry, who's known as Harry Miller, his byline was Henry Miller, but we knew him as Harry, had completely lost it. He was in his 60s. He just got completely pissed all the time. And we took it in turns just to file our own copy to The Telegraph.
Don't you miss copy takers? I loved copy takers.
I hated them.
Oh, but that is a lost profession,
isn't it? They always wanted to get off the phone. It was always, is there much more of this?
Much more of this shit.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
They had a sardonism about them that I really loved, because however above ourselves we got, because we'd got this world exclusive, they were not going to let you get above your station.
No.
I liked that.
They used to annoy me terribly sometimes. Some of them were very helpful. Some of them would even... I used to file an awful lot of copy without anything in front of me. When I did
off the top of your head,
Well, I did the Pope in Ireland, right? Mm-hmm. I was working for the Birmingham Evening Mail, And even in the late football paper that night, my news editor, terrific guy called Ian Mean, terrifically driven, said, look, I'm going to keep a column spare on the right-hand side of the sports edition for the Pope's speech, because the Pope was expected to make an appeal to the men, lay down your guns, you know, to the men of violence and all that. And you couldn't get in advance of the copy of the Pope's speech. You had to stand there and listen to it. And I had seconds to go before the Pope got up and he said it. And I didn't have time to take it down. I literally ran to a phone. There were no mobile phones in those days. Yeah. I got on a phone, so put me through the copy. There was a copy taker waiting there for my copy. And I reeled off about 15 paragraphs just off the top of my head. That's all I could do. I, you know, there was no way in the world I'd been able to write it down.
But we were trained to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
I was trained by, but you mentioned Linda Lee Potter.
Oh, right, yeah.
I was trained by her and by Jack Tinker, who always wrote the column Last Night's First Night in the Daily Mail.
Yes.
And he'd always have to file his piece during the interval.
That's right.
So we'd had to anticipate how it was going to go in the second half.
That's right.
But we'd go and stand in the lobby. He'd call copy, put me through, all of that.
That's right.
And he would just rattle it off the top of his head.
Sure.
And I had to stand there, listen and learn. And that's how you learned.
That's how you learned. Probably how your father learned. Did he do the World Cup final, 66?
He did 10 World Cups, my dad. Yes, and I remember he and my mother attended the World Cup final together.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay.
And he had held the Jules Rimet trophy.
Yes, that's right.
They drunk from the FA Cup trophy.
Yes.
You know, all of those great moments.
Yeah. And did you have all the pictures of that to remind you of it?
Endless pictures.
Yes. Great.
And his life was very full, and I can't be sad about it.
No.
I'll see him again.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course you will. And a life well lived. And
very
a life well
so.
Lived is a life
Thank
well
Thank you for paying tribute to him.
No problem at all. And just remind me, your father was born when?
1931, 11th of October 31.
Right.
Died 26th of September 2019. So he was a couple of weeks short of his 88th birthday.
Absolutely.
That is a long and lovely life.
Long and lovely life. Okay, folks, that was a tribute to the legendary sports reporter Ken Jones, mostly from his daughter, the wonderful Leslie Ann Jones. You have been listening to Planet Porky. Tune in again soon. Traditionally, right, if the thick son had failed to get into Oxford or Cambridge, he either went to the agricultural college at Cirencester or he went into the army.
Yeah.
They were the other two.
Not my type at all.
No.
I would prefer to be lured and talked into bed by somebody with
charm.
Literary tendencies and charm.
And wearing a nice suit.
You know, nice and clean.
Yes.
Completely scrubbed.
Yes.
I don't want any whiff of manure near
me,
mate.
No. Exactly.
This is not going to be my type.
I totally agree. So I just wonder why, who are these farmers shagging? Is it the local barmaid?
Maybe the sheep.
That's a bit harsh. Do you know, that is harsh, but quite seriously, because I come from Chester, and that's on the verge of North Wales, and we just talked about that. But when I was growing up, and, you know, people were in business and all that, they told me that it was not unusual for farmers, and this is a horrible subject, we'll mention it very briefly, to actually indulge in relationships with sheep.
Oh, sure, it is a thing. I loved copy days.
I hated them.
Oh, but that is a lost profession.
They always wanted to get off the phone. It was always, is there much more of this?
Much more of this shit.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
They had a sardonism about them that I really loved, because however above ourselves we got, because we'd got this world exclusive, they were not going to let you get above your station.
It is so provocative. Cher sitting astride a massive, you know, sort of huge gun barrel.
Okay.
Right, yeah, seriously.